From North Carolina to California, Alaska to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it is known as central bank digital currency, a replacement for cash that raises a wide range of privacy and civil liberty concerns. Ovik Roy from the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity is here to explain. Congress returned to work this week and grappled with how to address dealing with the nation's debt ceiling, which has already been reached. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Biden administration is attempting to implement by regulation new restrictions on the manufacture of gas-powered vehicles. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Philip Rossetti of the R Street Institute. And the left is once again trying to destroy U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas with yet another high-tech lynching. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Central bank digital currencies, they are, or would be, the government-controlled version of digital currencies such as Bitcoin, and that creates the opportunity for more government intrusion into the economic lives of every American. Ovik Roy is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, and he is the policy editor at Forbes. He joins us now to talk about such currencies. Ovik, welcome to American Radio Journal. Ovik, I'm willing to bet that most Americans have not heard of the term central bank digital currency. So they understand what we're talking about. What is central bank digital currency?
Well, you're absolutely right that this is a concept that's pretty new to most Americans. It's pretty new in general. People have only been talking about central bank digital currencies for a few years. But the basic idea is that once there was the emergence of Bitcoin, so Bitcoin was invented in 2008. It's now been around for about 15 years. And as Bitcoin has become bigger and more popular and has gotten a lot more attention, a lot of people in governments around the world have wondered, okay, is there something useful in this technology of Bitcoin that we can adapt to our own purposes? And the big idea that's come out of central banks, and by central banks, we're talking about the U.S. Federal Reserve and its counterparts around the world. These central banks have decided that one thing that they're very interested in is taking the technology that underlies Bitcoin, which is the blockchain, and using that to basically create a blockchain or cryptocurrency version of their own currency. So imagine that there's a crypto version of the U.S. dollar or a crypto version of the euro, or in China's case, a crypto version of the renminbi, which is their currency. And in particular, it has been China that has stepped out in front in terms of developing a central bank digital currency. And the reason why they've been particularly interested in this is because, unlike paper money, where if I give you a $10 bill, there's no necessarily written record of the fact that I gave you that $10 bill. With a central bank digital currency, every single transaction that you make with money, the government can see it. The government can know when you go to CVS and buy a can of Coke, the government will know that you did that, because literally every single transaction is in a database that this blockchain that would, instead of, unlike Bitcoin's blockchain, which is decentralized and controlled by nobody, a central bank digital currency's blockchain is controlled by the government. So what is it that China really loves about this? They love the fact that there's complete surveillance. Every single transaction that every Chinese citizen makes using their crypto version of the renminbi, their central bank digital currency, can be observed by the government. That's number one. Number two, the Chinese government can censor transactions. So let's say they don't like you. Let's say you've spoken out against the Chinese government. They can basically freeze your bank accounts because they can just turn off your ability to access that blockchain. A third thing they can do is program the money. So imagine a world in which, you know, right now the U.S. says, hey, we're going to pass a stimulus package and give people money that we hope they will spend and stimulate the economy. Well, imagine if that money came with an expiration date. If you don't spend the money by October, we're going to take it away from you. Or people can, the government can actually just take money in and out of your bank account because, again, they control the currency. It's all digital. They can just increase or decrease the amount you make. So China, for all these reasons, has been very excited by and has already rolled out. They rolled it out at the Beijing Winter Olympics, a central bank digital currency that they hope and intend for all their citizens to use in a way that will replace paper cash. And a number of central bankers in Western governments, including the United States, have been very interested in this idea of a central bank digital currency, some because they find the Chinese model very appealing, others who believe that we need to keep up with China and we have to have an American version of a central bank digital currency that could potentially protect Americans' privacy in ways that a Chinese central bank digital currency could not. So that's hopefully at least an introduction to the concept.
Where does this stand then, Ovik, in terms of bringing the central bank digital currencies to the United States? Who would have to approve that, and where do we stand in that process?
Well, this is a matter of debate. So there are some people in the government who believe that the Federal Reserve has the authority to develop a central bank digital currency on its own without any further authorization from anybody else. And there are efforts within the Federal Reserve and some certain corners of the Federal Reserve to investigate the possibility of the Federal Reserve developing its own central bank digital currency, or CBDC. And there are people who are working on how that might be designed. There are other people who argue vociferously that the Federal Reserve does not have the authority to develop a central bank digital currency without Congress's approval. Congress would have to amend the Federal Reserve Act, which is the law that created the Federal Reserve over 100 years ago, in order to authorize the Federal Reserve to create a central bank digital currency. So there's some people who believe that. But this is not an issue that's been settled by any court. We really don't know. I mean, and the Federal Reserve has actually been very crafty in its language at times, saying we don't intend to develop a CBDC without explicit authorization from Congress, but they have over the course of the last several years, not explicitly denied that they have that authority.
Given the concerns that you have raised, and we've seen what China has done with these CBDC currencies, is it even possible for there to be an American version that provides the protections of the civil liberties that we are accustomed to and value here in this country?
There are people who make that argument. So as I wrote in a recent Forbes piece, there are a number of prominent Republicans, most notably Chris Giancarlo, who was the director of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission under President Trump, who nicknames himself Crypto Dad. He's a guy who created an organization called the Digital Dollar Project, which he launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, with the intention of developing a central bank digital currency. And he argues that a central bank digital currency could be designed in a way that protects privacy. Now, I argue in the Forbes piece, and I'm not alone in arguing this, but I've been one of the earliest to argue it, that that's just a contradiction, a fundamental contradiction. You cannot have a digital currency with a comprehensive database of every single transaction and make that private. That's controlled by the government. You can't do it, because once the government controls it, they're going to have insight into every single one of those transactions. And the idea that somehow the government, one part of the government is going to stop another part of the government from looking at those transactions is just inconceivable. We see this with the IRS. Every few years, the IRS gets more power and more ability to look into our private transactions.
We have been talking with Ovik Roy, who is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He's also the policy editor at Forbes. And Ovik, tell us a bit about the foundation. Also, where on the web can folks go to learn more?
My think tank is called the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, as you said, or FREOP for short, FREOPP.org. And our mission is to use the tools of economic freedom and individual liberty to improve the lives of Americans on the bottom half of the ladder. So how do we show that progress and equality of opportunity and social mobility and the ability of people to rise up from humble beginnings comes from individual and economic freedom? So all of our work focuses on how to use economic freedom to reform the country and make it more mobile and more accessible to the vast majority of people.
Ovik Roy from the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Ovik, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks a lot.
Congress is back in session, and a number of really big issues, as usual, are before them. We're going to talk about them today with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
One of the things that has been perking along here now for a number of months, Scott, and we have touched upon it in the past, is this issue of the nation hitting its debt limit and where we go to from here and how. With Congress back in session, has there been any movement on this issue?
Congress hit the statutory debt limit, meaning now Treasury is engaged in selling off various assets to meet our debt obligations and avoid a default on our nation's debt. So as they continue that process, it kind of lights the fire underneath Congress of, hey, we better do something about the debt and deficit issue now. Otherwise, when it comes time to the so-called X date, when they can no longer sell off assets, and we hit the firm limit on our revenue and spending and the nation's debt, what are they going to do? How are they going to increase it? And so there's been this fiscal negotiation for the last several months, and that's really starting to heat up here in Washington now that we're in the middle of April. This week, Congress came back into session, and Kevin McCarthy had what's known as the Republican conference meeting. It's when all the House Republicans get together and they talk about the various issues in front of them. And front and center was that negotiation on the debt limit. You've got a bipartisan group of what I would call the rhinos and the moderate Democrats that are trying to basically punt the issue as far down the road as they can. And so what they've offered through the Problem Solvers Caucus, which obviously isn't solving the problem of our debt and deficit, is basically to create a new fiscal commission that will have a vote in 2025 on how to deal with the debt and deficit issue. I think that that's a non-starter when it comes to the real negotiation that's happening among House conservatives and the Speaker's office. They, on the other hand, have made great strides forward. And right now, we think that there could be about $1 trillion in deficit reduction over the next year, meaning in the first year, not a 10-year score, but in the first year, in exchange for about a $1.5 trillion debt limit increase that would bring us into May of 2024. So that would mean that the debt limit negotiation needs to be restarted again during the presidential year. Now, of course, this is sort of like the first move of a bicameral, bipartisan negotiation. And if the House can pass legislation, it'll be up to the Senate to either move that bill through the United States Senate or to come up with their own package that can pass the Senate and still pass the House of Representatives.
Also at play in Congress this last couple of weeks, Scott, we have these nominations for federal judges for judicial posts, and they have to go to the Senate for confirmation. This has become somewhat of an issue with Senator Dianne Feinstein absent. We have several senators who have had health problems and where we stand on their return and the impact on the confirmation process and other legislation.
This week, Republican leader Mitch McConnell did return to the United States Senate following an absence. He had a fall where he had a concussion and I think broke some ribs. So he was back, and John Fetterman was released from Walter Reed for his treatment with depression and I think some other health issues. So the two of them are back. The Senate's almost at full strength, but the big missing piece is career politician Dianne Feinstein, who accrued all this significant power on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And right now, the Senate Judiciary Committee doesn't have the votes to issue subpoenas, and they don't have the votes to report out these radical nominations from the Biden administration. So there was some pressure from other members in California calling on Dianne Feinstein to resign. Nancy Pelosi strongly came out in support of Feinstein, but the work of the United States Senate and the partisan plans from the Democrats have been dramatically slowed down given her absence. So they offered a unanimous consent request earlier this week to temporarily remove Feinstein from the Senate Judiciary Committee and replace her with Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland. Well, the good news is Republicans held strong in objecting to that consent request. And maybe this is a little bit inside baseball, but if they're going to be able to jam down these radical nominations in both the executive branch and the judiciary, Republicans would have been basically adhering to that plan by allowing for Feinstein to be replaced on the committee. So through the objection, now they can only do nominations that are bipartisan in nature, and those are only going to pass if they've got significant Republican support. So it's a good move by Senate Republicans. You have many of them that stood in line there to do the objection. And I think that we should all be encouraged by their willingness right now to fight back against these radical judges and radical nominees that are trying to influence the American economy through really like the social governance, equity, inclusion, diversity, all the stuff that they've got out there that they're trying to fundamentally change America. Right now, Republicans are able to basically block most of that.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth, and typically we do end with Scott telling us a little bit about the club, so why don't we do that now, Scott?
Club for Growth is a membership organization united in the idea of economic opportunity, liberty, and freedom. Anybody can become a member for free by signing up at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Biden administration is attempting to implement new regulations to push the production of electric vehicles ahead of market forces. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Philip Rossetti of the R Street Institute.
So the Biden administration is making some waves with a new rule that might effectively ban all non-electric vehicles from the United States by 2032, less than a decade from now. But the big question is really, well, does the administration have the authority to do that? And we're going to take a close look at that here today with my friend Philip Rossetti. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. As I mentioned, Philip Rossetti, senior fellow at the R Street Institute, is here with us today to talk about this new proposed rule from the Biden administration, Phil. And this draws upon, I guess, first of all, thanks for taking some time with us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
This draws upon the federal CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy standards. Federal regulators basically have the ability to set standards for the emissions that come out of the back of your car, and they're changing them. They're tightening them quite severely.
Yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell. So CAFE, the corporate average fuel economy standards, are usually what you think of when you think like miles per gallon. Under the same authority under the Clean Air Act, EPA says, hey, you know, we can regulate emissions and we can set these standards. So why don't we just go further? Why don't we set a standard that is effectively impossible for most combustion engine vehicles to comply with? And the idea is if you set a low enough standard, then you're going to force, they estimate, 2/3 of the vehicles sold in the United States to be electric or low carbon vehicle. That's kind of it in a nutshell, but this is something that regulators have tried in the past, and it hasn't always worked out in their favor.
Yeah, so the big question here is exactly how far can regulators go? You have a piece up at rstreet.org this week looking at exactly those questions. And the one thing that you focus on in there is this idea of being beyond the fence line. And I guess to be beyond the fence line, we have to understand where the fence line is. How far can regulators go? And that's not really that's not a clear standard, honestly.
No, it's not at all. And this is a really fun topic because it was debated for years. But back during the Obama administration, you know, some folks might remember there was this Clean Power Plan that came out pretty much at the end. It was the end of 2015 that he came up with this rule, or finalized, I should say. And the Supreme Court said, well, hang on a second. We're not really sure if you can do this, because what the Clean Power Plan did was basically the same thing that the EPA is trying to do with vehicles. They said, we're going to set a emission standards for power plants that are so low that coal basically can't comply with it, so it forced a transition away from coal. And then Justice Antonin Scalia died after the Supreme Court stayed the rule, but before they could actually make a decision on it. So this sparked years of questions about, okay, does the EPA have this authority? And they called it the fence line, because the idea was, okay, there's the fence around the power plant and the EPA can regulate the power plant, but can they set regulations that affect people outside of the power plant? Can they set regulations that affect how you can consume and what you must buy? And we finally got an answer to this question last year. It was a big case, West Virginia versus EPA. It was really monumental because the Biden administration didn't have a Clean Power Plan 2.0 at the time. There wasn't something that was being debated other than this question. And they called the major questions doctrine. They said, courts need to decide this, not the bureaucrats. And the courts basically said, no, EPA does not have this authority. EPA can only regulate in a manner that's consistent with setting reasonable standards. They can't set standards that are so difficult to comply with that it forces some big change in behavior outside of the regulated entities.
It seems like there's a pretty clear parallel there. We're talking with Philip Rossetti. He's a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute on energy policy, talking about the new CAFE standards, the new standards for emissions from vehicles that could effectively make a lot of internal combustion engines illegal in cars within the next decade. Phil, not a whole lot of time left here, but you mentioned the major questions doctrine. Obviously, that's something that's been batted around in front of the court quite a bit lately. I think it's interesting the way this could, and I guess almost certainly will, go in front of the courts eventually. Biden maybe doesn't lose anything politically by trying to push this new standard, but ultimately this is a question that is going to give us a better sense of the way the Supreme Court views that that major questions doctrine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be interesting to see how the courts want to handle this. There's very little doubt in my mind that it will get challenged, and it's unlikely that I think the Supreme Court would go along with this rule. But how they actually make a ruling on it also matters, because traditionally the courts would wait until the rule was appealed and sent to them, and then they would eventually rule on it. But now with the major questions doctrine, where they kind of preempted something that they knew they would say was not within EPA's authority, there's a question of, okay, would they do something like that again? And what's the new dynamic for how regulators are challenged in court? And we just don't know what that's going to look like yet.
Yeah, and just to draw a line under that, I mean, because the old way of doing it was you'd have to wait for this rule to be in effect, and then somebody who's negatively affected by it would have to bring a legal challenge. And I mean, by that point, you're already 10 years down the road, and all these changes have already been made to the industry, right? So this really kind of it flips the relationship there of when you can bring this legal challenge.
Yeah, and that's part of the strategy for regulators is sometimes they'll impose a regulation, and by the time there's actually some sort of ruling on it, it doesn't matter anymore.
And this could definitely flip that. Interesting stuff, Phil. Thank you for filling us in. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Again, that's Philip Rossetti from the R Street Institute. Check out his work online at rstreet.org. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. You can check out everything that we're covering here, including the new rules for vehicles, new rules for cars that the Biden administration has issued, and everything else going on in Washington and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is once again in the crosshairs of the left-wing commentariat, which is trying to force his resignation from the bench. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA discusses the politics of the situation on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In 1991, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was the target of what he unforgettably called a high-tech lynching. Now, some 32 years later, a new lynch mob has formed, and Justice Thomas is once again its target. The new lynch mob is not made up of senators on the Judiciary Committee, but rather the progressive commentariat. Justice Thomas was able to look each senator in the eye in 1991, and they backed off. Today, his accusers hide behind a media screen. The accusations against Thomas are inaccurate reporting on financial disclosure forms. The implications behind the accusations are that he corrupted himself by accepting the hospitality of a wealthy friend, namely Texas real estate developer Harlan Crow. There is no evidence presented that any improper influence occurred, only that he failed to report the gifts from a friend. Thomas defended himself with a rather weak assertion that he was told by several unnamed advisors that he was not required to report such instances. The obvious goal of his accusers is to get him to resign or be impeached so that President Biden can select a successor who will reduce the conservative majority on the court. That is intuitively obvious. What may not be so obvious is what I believe the real motive is and why it's happening right now. Not just replacing conservative Justice Thomas with any progressive, but rather replacing him with one particular person, Vice President Kamala Harris. As a pro-choice female of color, she would be a trifecta for Biden. She'd tick the gender, race, and ideology boxes while also getting her out of the first position of consideration if Biden were not to run again, or worse yet, if anything were to happen to him prior to the end of his term. As vice president, Harris is a constant source of embarrassment to the president. But as a Supreme Court justice, clerks and other staff could keep her public appearances and opportunities for gaffes at a minimum, and they could author credible decisions in her name. As a former district attorney in San Francisco, attorney general of California, and United States senator, her resume is impressive. The Democratic majority in the Senate is paper thin and probably short-lived, so the time to strike is now. But without an opening, how could she be appointed? By creating an opening through either forcing a resignation or successfully impeaching and removing a justice. Of the nine, Clarence Thomas is the juiciest target. Not only is he one of the most conservative justices, he is also something that liberal progressive Democrats hate with an unholy obsession, a black Republican. The level of racism aimed at black conservatives by liberals is, I believe, the most intense and hateful of any form of racism in 21st century America. Listen to Francis Guess, a longtime civil rights leader and former commissioner of two Tennessee state agencies. He said Clarence Thomas, quote, isn't getting the job done as a representative of African Americans on the nation's highest court. I look at it like he is our minister of defense. If I were in Israel and we had a Jewish minister of defense who only lived in the Palestinian community, who only associated with Palestinians, who was married to a Palestinian, who advocated the return of the occupied territories to the Palestinians, wouldn't the Jewish people view him with suspicion? I view our Supreme Court justice with suspicion, close quote. Representative Benny Thomas called Justice Thomas an Uncle Tom, citing his support for voter ID and opposition to affirmative action. Samuel L. Jackson called Justice Thomas Uncle Clarence. Congressman Burgess Owens said that Justice Thomas, quote, doesn't like black people. He doesn't like being black. Close quote. That is pure racist vitriol. Progressives want to own the black vote. Yes, I said own. Think about it. But they don't own Clarence Thomas. What the lynch mob is saying about Clarence Thomas is vile. There's no credible claim of improper influence. If the good justice erred in filing his forms, and it's anything but certain that he did, then he should pay a fine, just like so many others who make similar errors. In the meantime, the listeners to American Radio Journal should come to Justice Thomas's defense by contacting their elected representatives and local media in his support and exposing the venality of those who are trying to take him down. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WHYP-LP, in Cory, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.